this then. Whoa, pardon me. Oh, oh, gosh. Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Greetings, Goofsters, and welcome to episode 7 of the Two Goofs Podcast, the 12-part series exploring the life of a costume character at Disneyland as told by two best friends who lived it. I'm the goof who's always aloof, Adam, and with me as always, my co-pilot on this goof-tastic voyage, Jeff.
Yuck, yuck, hey.
We want to, once again, take time to thank everyone who has reached out to us on social media with your kind words about the show. It's popping up in random conversation for me now, so just like, people are like, oh, by the way, love Two Goofs. I'm like, oh, thank you. How about this other thing? Yeah, like I said, I love Two Goofs. But it does make sharing these stories that much more enjoyable to know you're out there ready for more of these behind-the-scenes memories of the Disneyland experience from the other side of the mask. But this is kind of interesting in that there's been some news from the park lately that's really kind of blown up on social media and also some other concepts here. So, Jeff, I know you had a little bit of news. You want to share that?
It was something my wife was talking about that was a huge thing in the news that everybody was talking about. So we felt like for our podcast, if we didn't even mention it, we would not be, especially doing a podcast about what it was like for work for Disney. I'm sure many of you heard Abigail Disney, Walt Disney's granddaughter, was blasting the company over a pay discrepancy, talking about that there's an over 1,000 to 1 pay ratio between how much the CEO, Bob Iger, is paid as opposed to how much the employees are paid. And I don't know how much we've talked about it on this podcast because we're trying to remember kind of the positive side of working there. I mean, definitely as a large company, that is definitely one thing that they keep successful by paying what they can pay. And I think we'll talk about this on a future podcast, like the career aspect of the character department. And that was always my view, is that they paid us exactly enough so that we wouldn't quit. We don't have to pay you more, because as long as you don't quit, but we're not going to pay you less. So we're going to keep you at just that fine number, so you can just scrape together enough to pay rent and to feed yourself, and that's about all. And that was rough, and again, we'll talk about that in a future podcast. So I appreciate what she's saying, even though I think most companies would say something similar. That's just kind of how they do business, sadly, in America today. And the discrepancies between the very high paid and the minimum wage people working at the parks is a bummer, but I think it's kind of more of a statement on the American working class personally. But
yeah, so that's good though, that the Disney's sticking up for the employees. We appreciate that.
Which we should say, the Disney's, not Disney. They definitely are not on the same page right now.
Different factions there, right. Yeah, these days. Speaking of which, so the other big bit of news, which was kind of disturbing and a little crazy, was the Toontown fight. Yes, there was a fight that broke out in the streets of Toontown. I don't know what that's saying. Is Mickey the mayor of Toontown? I feel like he's got to bring some peace to the streets. But if you've seen this footage, I'm assuming everybody has. Basically, there's these two couples that are arguing, you know, just in the middle of the street. And all of a sudden, they start throwing punches, and they're literally just, like, beating each other up, but it's like the guys are punching the girls are punching the guys, like, everybody is fighting everybody, and it went on for, like, 4 minutes. Like, there's so much, you obviously, everybody flipped out their phones, flipped out, nobody has a flip phone anymore, but everybody took out their phones and made sure they were getting footage of this, and, like, you know, different guests are trying to break it up and stuff, but it goes on for 4 minutes of these people attacking each other, and it's one of those things where you're just like, wow, like, is this what it's come to? Like, how did this happen? I actually saw a follow-up article, kind of a clickbait headline that says, couples involved in Toontown fight claim it never happened. Which in our day and age, that's very difficult to do. But I have a feeling that our listeners were probably curious to know, Jeff, did you ever witness anything of that nature of guests being nasty to each other or like actual physical violence in your time there?
Yeah, I mean, not to that extreme. It's a tough thing when you get 57,000 people together, and especially when you get in, like, you throw a character in there that somehow a character's autograph is a thing of value, and so then they're fighting over a thing of value, and then the I got threatened, but, you know, that a guy said, I'm about to punch Goofy in the face. And I was like, excuse me? So I left.
Well, there you go. Hey, that's what you get here on the Two Goofs podcast. Well, on a happier note, and speaking to your point, Jeff, in lieu of goof mail this week, I decided to throw out a poll onto Twitter because I wanted to find out really, where are people at these days? Because again, we're speaking of a perspective almost 20 years back. And so if we look at that now, we say, is it really still that way? Find out about a fight in Toontown? Is it getting worse? What is it? So my question to our listeners and our followers on Twitter was, what is your preferred interaction with costume characters at the Disney parks? So nowadays, when you go, what are you there for? And Jeff, I think you will be very happy and relieved to know, of the three choices, take a photograph, get an autograph, or create a magic moment, overwhelmingly, 78% said they wanted to create a magic moment.
I feel like that's kind of a weighted thing, though. this, or a magical experience with all, you know.
I just wanted to bring a smile to your face, Jeff, right, however okay. Fallible my... my poll-taking skills, maybe. So, today we have a bit of an unconventional show in that we are not directly discussing the work of being a costume character, but rather who we worked with and the hijinks that ensued on the job and after hours. We are calling this episode our Break Room Buddies episode because there's just so many people that you get a chance to interact with at Disney and you make friends and you might make an enemy here or there or people that you just have to tolerate. So we're going to get into all of that. But I think it's important to preface these experiences with the fact that we were in our late teens and early 20s when all of these stories went down. So we were barely adults, and in some cases, you know, sowing our wild oats, though neither of us were particularly deviant. I don't want to create that impression, but also, we're going to be mentioning, you know, first names of these people in some cases, but maybe omitting others, not for any major reason, but just, you know, occasionally privacy in our minds might say, yeah, maybe, you know, just keep in mind this was 20 years ago, so these folks that worked with us were still figuring out life like we were in a lot of cases, so.
Well, but at the same time, yes, I would say the vast majority of people working in the character department were probably in their early 20s, college students a lot, but not all. So to say that everybody was still... No, I mean, we worked with some 30 and 40-year-olds and like you know...
The 60-year-olds.
Sure, yeah. People that had been there for a while. So it's not like we're all a bunch of kids. The two of us certainly were. But like for me, and especially I work with high school kids, so a lot of them, you know, are heading off to college here in the next couple of weeks. It is that interesting thing. Like I didn't go away to college. Both of us went to junior college and then I transferred to a four-year after quite a few years. So not having that college experience or living in a dorm and doing all that sort of... So for me, Disney was my college experience. Like that was where I kind of learned those lessons that I think you learn when you go away to college. I learned a lot of those life lessons at Disneyland. So a lot of these experiences, yes, you called them sowing your wild oats. At least for me... I would go more into, like, people have college stories and we have Disney stories.
Exactly. And one milestone that we should mention is that while working at Disney, Jeff finally moved out of his parents' house. I, on the other hand, went from living in my childhood home to a very different situation, which was living in a dead guy's house. I'll explain my situation, then Jeff can tell us a bit about his experience living on his own with his character department co-workers in Disney apartments, we'll call them. So I'll just say here, my parents are divorced, and after he moved out, my dad usually just rented rooms because he spent a lot of time at the office. He just needed a place to sleep or get cleaned up. So it just so happened that he ended up renting a room from a widowed elderly guy named Ernie. Now, Ernie was always on an oxygen tank, but he was still a barrel of laughs. And I think he was from the South. I can't remember if he was from like New Orleans or where exactly, but he's always like, oh, Adam, let me tell you. Oh, this is so funny. Oh, yeah, da, da, da. You know, so he was kind of like Adam Sandler's, you know, the water boy, all those people. Anyway, after a while, as happens to us all, Ernie eventually died. And so it took a while for his kids to settle up on his affairs. So they just let my dad keep living in the house for a year or two until they decided how they were going to sell it and divide it all up. And during this period, my dad invited me to take the master bedroom in the home. And as a young single guy looking for freedom, this seemed like a great opportunity. I'm going to live rent-free. All right. But the trade-off was, It was a dead guy's house that I was basically squatting in, you know, because we weren't allowed to pack anything up. So all Ernie's family pictures are still up on the walls. I'm sleeping in his bed using his bathroom. I mean, it was like living in the Haunted Mansion without the grim grinning ghosts, right? You know, nobody's there to socialize with me. It wasn't actually haunted yet. And my dad wasn't home much, so it was, in my mind, like having my own place, but totally not. That was where I was at while I was working at Disney. Now, Jeff, you moved to Anaheim or an adjacent area to be closer to work. What can you tell us about the Disney apartment experience?
Yeah, so same thing. My parents got divorced, and so I stayed home till I was 21, I believe, and then I moved out. And my roommates had lived there for a while, but I'm guessing that the people before me had just moved out. So basically, it was a two-bedroom apartment down the street from Disneyland. And in the two bedrooms, there were two people in. So there was four of us total, two guys and two girls. So myself and one of the guys that I worked with, Mike, we shared a bedroom. And then Kalissa and Jamie were in the other bedroom. And the funny thing was, is that for me, like, because, you know, I was commuting from Irvine, so it was certainly nicer to commute from down the street rather than having to worry about traffic or anything like that. Although, like we've mentioned before, without traffic, the drive from Irvine to Disneyland is maybe 20 minutes. It's not a bad commute. But my roommate, Mike, who just had moved in, he had moved in slightly before I had. So his story, which he kept saying, like, oh, those were the days. He used to live in Hesperia or Valencia. It was basically by Victorville. He had a 90-minute commute each direction without traffic every single day to come and work at Disneyland. So he was, before moving into our apartment, he would work the 6 a.m. shift, leaving at 3:30 a.m. every single day and getting home about 5. He's like, yeah, but rent out here is so cheap. It's like $600 for my own apartment. Yeah, but you're driving 3 hours each day to work for...
This was not uncommon, because on the other side, coming from the other direction, there was a gal who was goofy height, one of the few female goofies, who lived, I believe, out towards San Diego, and she would commute up to work at Disneyland and do her shifts.
But no, let's not say, this was very uncommon. That's why we remember the two people who did this, because... Yeah. Like, the numbers just didn't add up. When you thought about how much money you spent in gas, and you spent 3 hours of your life so that you could get a $9 an hour job, like, no. The interesting thing was, and I think for a lot of people, again, this is kind of my experience, like, with dorm life, where everybody has a roommate and same, you got an entire dorm, we just had an apartment. We were definitely not the party house. Like, I don't think we had a single party in the years that I lived there. The one thing, though, that was pretty fun, that because I moved in shortly before season 2 of American Idol. So American Idol, though, was our apartment's thing. All of us would get together, even Kalissa's boyfriend would come in together, and we would all watch American Idol religiously. Every single week, it was like, everybody, come on, it's American Idol time. And we'd all get together, we all had our favorites, and we would pick who was going to win. I was gung-ho, I still am. Clay Aiken got robbed that year. So we were all very invested in that, so that's why I auditioned for the third season.
And what was your song, Jeff?
Under the Boardwalk by the Drifters.
Classic.
I wimped out on the high note.
Now, I would visit every once in a while, and I just thought Jeff was the coolest guy. I'm like, he's got his own apartment. It's like Friends, man. You know, he's living with these random people. They're all different kinds of characters. But as Jeff mentioned, maybe the long commute to work, you know, the prestige job of being a costume character at Disneyland, not as common as maybe I thought it was. But this communal living experience with characters, you know, sharing the rent was pretty common. I mean, as you'll recall, we had our friend Nikki on in our bonus episode, and she talked about how she had to find a roommate at her audition. You know, she's like, oh, we're both new in town, let's find an apartment, you know, type of thing. So that was fun. Now, when we got to work, though, that was where you really ran into all sorts of different characters. Just like any workplace, you know, there are many different people for many different reasons, and it creates an interesting mix. So I feel like there's a few folks we're just never going to forget. You know, some people were just cool or just a lot of fun, or were like the veterans. You know, like there was one guy named Peter. And he was kind of like head goofy is how I always saw him.
Yeah, true.
Like, he had been there for years and years, but he was also just, like, a lot of fun, and he'd, like, mess around with people and just have a good time. So Peter was kind of, you know, King Goofy, but then there was the jester of Goofies, I guess is how I would put it. And it was a guy named Jason, and...
Jason was the jester?
Yeah, well... Maybe well, not on purpose.
I should say, Jason was the one that everyone was baffled. How has this guy not gotten fired yet? Because he has so many stories of, like, seriously, he did that? Like, how are you still here?
And this is a story I heard secondhand. Jeff, I assume you were not present for this either.
No, nobody was.
There was an awards dinner. Somebody was receiving some sort of award from the company, kind of like a lifetime achievement deal. And from my understanding, the statuette, you know, the award itself, took the shape of a crystal Goofy.
Yeah, handcrafted, one of a kind. Now, and the thing that should be pointed out is that, one, Jason was not a kid. This was not some 19-year-old. Like, he was in his mid to late 20s, but he was kind of known for not having the most common sense. So he would do things that were like, seriously, you thought that was a good idea?
And so in this case, he stayed true to his brand, and his responsibility was, you're going to come out as Goofy, since the award is a Goofy award, you're going to present it to this person, and it's going to be this touching moment, you know? A Disney character is going to deliver the honor. And so he decided it was going to be a great idea. What if he could do a gag? What if he could balance the statue on Goofy's nose while he's carrying it out and present it to this person that way? Well, Goofy's nose is not a flat or stable area. You know, we've talked about people putting an autograph book up there and taking the time to sign. That's a whole different scenario than when you're trying to balance, you know, a weighted object. And so, as you can imagine, he's walking out, it falls to the ground and shatters. And as it was explained to me, it was just silence. Like, nobody could believe what just happened. And it really put a damper on the evening. Who's to know if that priceless object was ever replaced? But yeah, so you would hear those people, and then that reputation, like Jeff said, that just carries with you. You don't live that down. Yeah. Jeff, is there someone in particular for you that stands out that you're like, oh, this person was so unique?
Oh, lots of them. It's that thing, too, that's funny. And part of the thing that I think is universal about The Office, even if you've not worked in an office before, is the cast of characters. And the fact that if you have worked in an office, you know every office has a Dwight. Every office has a Stanley. And so it's the same thing. Like, we had plenty of Dwights and Stanleys and Angelas. And I know one that we had, which I feel like he must have come up at some point on the show, maybe not, but we had a host named Chris.
Oh yes.
And the great thing about Chris was Chris did have a heart of gold. We loved Chris. There was no, like, some of the other people, they might have been a little bit rougher on the edges and kind of hard to like, but Chris, there were so many things where, like, wow, only Chris could have done something like that. He appeared on Judge Joe Brown at one point. That was kind of his highlight. What was it? A dog attacked him while he was riding his bicycle to work, and the guy was trying to sue him for injuring the dog. If you could ever find, I mean, I don't know how you would find this clip, but the clip of him explaining his case to Judge Joe Brown, and the judge's face is just like, what? And he's just talking. It was like a cartoon, man. I could see the dog's eyes just go, boo, as it was like feasting on my bicycle. And then it went and it just charged me. I'm like, it was a chihuahua, right? Okay. He was definitely a colorful character.
Yeah, and I mean, he had the Toontown rap, and he had all sorts of different things that he would bust out. Now, another character that I ran into one time, because I don't think I mentioned it on this show heavily, but I'm a major fan of the band Kiss, but Jeff has had to endure much of my fandom. So one of our coworkers one day really got my attention, because I was telling him, you know, how big a fan I was, and I was probably listening to an album. I always had my CD player with music in the break room, and I remember him coming up. He's like, oh yeah, no, I met Paul the other night. It's my friend Pat Benatar. We were just hanging out. It was her birthday, and so she just wanted a quiet party, and she invited Paul Stanley over. I guess they're friends, and he had just come from a concert, so he still had his makeup on, and he was just there to wish her a happy birthday. So we all just had a great night together, and I was like, what? You met Paul Stanley? That's so cool. And I'm like asking him all these questions and things like that, and he's like, oh yeah, well, gotta go out of my set. And then one of the hosts comes up to me, and she's like, By the way, you know he's a compulsive liar, right? He's not messing with you, but he's always telling these stories. And none of them are true. And I was like, oh, I see. I had not run into anybody who was really, and again, I don't think he was insincere. I think there was other things going on, but I'm a very gullible person, or at least I was back in those days.
Oh, but not anymore. No, no.
Oh, no. That was always one that stood out to me. Jeff, you got another crazy character for backstage?
The more you get to know them, obviously, they become less caricatures and more actual people. So, like, the biggest one, and we mentioned him, I think, on our very first episode, was Joe. And he was the one that we talked about that grabbed me when I was in the Queen of Hearts and said, "You look like a joke. Go work for Knott's Berry Farm." And that was his reputation. He was notorious for really giving it to rookies. He made a Snow White cry at one point for telling her what a joke that she was. Yeah, he was.
I could back that up. I got the brunt of Joe for sure. Joe would always like make fun of me when I laughed because I have a very broad smile, I would say. It's very toothy. He'd be like, and he would like do buck teeth, and he would just like pick on me. And every time he would walk by me, he'd go like, "You're lost soul, Pope." And yeah, that was his thing. He was the collector of lost souls.
Yes, and that was the interesting thing. Again, getting to know Joe later on and just kind of figuring out he was obviously, you know, he's a real human being. He's not just a caricature, but just knowing, and which is even that weird thing, even like Adam's talking about, if you would have told me 3 years before that Joe is going to be one of my friends, I'd be like, "That guy?" Like, no. He's a bully. He just likes to pick on people, which is probably true, but, you know, getting to know somebody like that is also interesting, so.
Now, one other character I was going to mention is there was a gal who worked with us, and she was very animated. She was very excited, just out of costume. But she went by the nickname Cricket because she would walk around and make this cricket noise, which I cannot duplicate. But I assume she had done it since she was a kid. So that was just kind of like in a quiet moment. If nothing was going on, you would hear the cricket noise come out, yeah, you know, if she wanted to get your attention. So I always found her interesting. But there was another guy that I did not get along with. If I had a rival at Disney, it was this guy named Andrew. And, you know, he was like, you know, strapping, young, good-looking guy like me. Maybe that's where the competition was. But he was just, like, super confident and, in my mind, overconfident. And, you know, again, when you're a young guy, you kind of have that pride, and that's working in your favor in some cases and maybe not so much otherwise. But we would be doubles at Goofy's Kitchen every once in a while. And I'd have to, you know, switch off with him. And I remember one time he was going to help me, like, put the pin to pin my hat. I was like, "I got it, man. I don't need your help." You know, he's like, "Whatever, man." You know, it's like we really, like, would go back and forth about different stuff. But he was always, you got to remember, this is, like, 2001, you know, this era where a rave is, like, the coolest thing you could do. At least in, you know, suburban Orange County. "Oh, I'm going to a rave up in L.A., you know, or whatever. And so he was always doing these hand motions. He was always practicing these raver moves. And he told me, "Oh yeah, it's called liquid. This is like liquid movements, you know, and like your hands would trace each other together and move in unison and all this stuff." And I was like, "Show off." Like, and, you know, I did not enjoy that he thought he was so cool. So like that was a guy, like, again, I didn't really have any ill will towards anybody in the department, but he just rubbed me the wrong way. Eventually, I just apologized. I said, "Look, I know we don't get along. I know I'm giving you attitude. I don't want to have that tension. So can we just like agree to disagree?" He's like, "Yeah, it's cool, man. Whatever." I don't even care about you anyway, so go ahead and apologize.
Well, it's interesting, yeah, like you said, and that's something that I probably realized later, is that, and I remember hearing that, or I feel like I saw a show where they said this, the thing that drives you craziest about other people are the things that you struggle with. Yeah. And so, just like you were saying, Adam, like, that was definitely the thing for me, is that I have really struggled with pride in my life, and so the people that came in that were arrogant, like, that really resonated, like, even more so than with other character flaws. Like, that was the one that would, yeah, that would definitely drive me crazy. And so people bragging about, like, we had one, I don't remember what his name was. He wasn't around very long, which was the one thing that we did mention. And that was really interesting working there as long as I did, is that I definitely got to see what the veterans were talking about with the turnover, is that, you know, the average turnover, I think we said 80% of people were gone within a year. So a lot of people would be there for a season, there for a year, there for a summer. And like, that's all you'd get to know them. And some of the more colorful ones would definitely stand out. But a lot lot of these people were the ones that were around longer than that. But yeah, that was definitely the thing about like, oh, like the kids coming in and bragging about how great they were. And I'm like, yeah, but you are brand new and you're probably going to be gone within a couple of months. So take it down a notch there, Tiger.
Which reminds me, there was a guy who had a very distinct hairstyle for a while where he would do like a mohawk spike in the middle. This is before like faux hawks.
Yeah.
And he would come and he would like bow his head violently and go, slice!
Oh, Tim! Oh, Tim! Oh, I
still
follow.
And he would slice you with his hair.
Tim, I hope you're listening. I love you, man. Tim, I still keep up with you on Facebook. And I think he is still working at Disneyland, actually.
Oh, really?
And Tim, yeah. The funny thing about it, once you get to know him, is that that was not a character defining. I mean, it was in the fact that he was just a goofball. He was just such a dork, and that's what you loved about him. But other ones, like, I remember we had one kid, which, again, I don't, because he was kind of here and gone again, who I remember he was a younger kid, probably 18, 19, and one of our leads, Marla, was talking to him at Goofy's Kitchen about his career aspirations. And he's like, well, I've kind of got it narrowed down to two, but I'm not sure. Like, deadpan serious. This is not a joke. He's deadpan, like, I'm either going to be, like, a rock star or a professional baseball player, but I can't decide which one I'm going to be. And she's like, ha, 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 oh, okay. And it was funny that it was like, not only being 18, but just like, wow, do you even play baseball? Not at a professional level. And it's kind of that sad thing with the different heights. The vast majority of the Mickey height were typically female. We had a couple of guys that were of that height that they definitely like stood out because they were, you know, a guy that was under 5 feet tall. And so that there we had Michael and we had Brad. And then on the flip side, we really only had, I think, two females that were taller than 6 feet. And especially not seeing a lot of those in this culture, it is, I mean, a little intimidating sometimes. And so, like, we already mentioned the one gal that was commuting from San Diego. She was a goofy height. She was very similar to our friend Jason, I should say. She was an interesting character. And then we had another tall, goofy gal that she was very opposite. She was not terribly friendly. And, I mean, there's no rule that you have to be. Yeah, there's a lot of stories that go along with her. But I do want to mention other colorful characters. So I'll mention two of them in particular. Sterling and David. Sterling was a face character. David was a Pluto height character. But at least for me as a performer, there are certain people that you just click with. And especially when you're performing and you're not able to use words, just kind of that silent communication where you're just on the same wavelength and you start improvising and they just go with it. Like, that's a special, special thing. Like, honestly, as long as you and I have known each other, Adam, we don't have that kind of chemistry. I'm not on your wavelength. Like, you're on your own wavelength, man. But for me and Sterling and me and David, like, we totally had that. So that was really, especially as a Goofy and a Pluto, being able to just start riffing. And we only worked together a handful of times. But Sterling was a face character, and he would do, like, the Mad Hatter. And he was spectacular as the Mad Hatter. I don't know how, honestly, he was to the character. Like, I don't know if it was that. But I would always just follow him around because I knew whatever I was doing, not just that he would be on the same wavelength, he would somehow take it and make it even better. Where it was just, oh, it was a delight to just watch him. And like, I really had to kind of stifle my own laughter being inside of the costume and wanting to be silent. And just there would be sometimes I'd just be bent over laughing. I mean, silently.
Sterling, to me, he always felt like an MTV VJ. Like, he was just like the coolest guy in the room, could relate to anybody, was super nice, but he always had like a quip. He was just real quick-witted. So yeah, I can see, like, a definitely character. Like you said, he maybe wasn't doing 100% the Ed Wynn voice. You know, he wasn't pushing that super hard, but he was just entertaining 100%, could pick up on any little idiosyncrasy of the guests that he was interacting with.
Because then there was another David that I know you were a, if not a fan of, at least interested in. So there was a David that said he was a Latino comedian.
Yes.
I'm not sure.
I'm very big in Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that could have just been his personality, like, especially with Adam being Adam. I'm a Spanish comedian. Really? A Spanish comedian? Sure I am, kid. Like, it's interesting because, you know, the people inside the costumes are real people and they're not all saints. And David was, he kind of made me uncomfortable because there would be plenty of references that he'd make to, or he'd make like a joke about something that he saw on set. or he'd make a joke offset, and then I'd see him play it out while he's on set, but only we could get it because it was like an inside joke. And there were some of them, he had kind of a crass sense of humor, so he'd do something where he'd just be like, oh, that's so gross, man. And like, the audience wouldn't get that it was gross because they didn't see what, like, they couldn't understand the reference, but we could. But so there was a couple of those that was just like, oh. For me, the interesting thing coming from high school, a profession, is that it's a very different atmosphere. Whereas in high school, like, you see those same people every single day, and it's almost like you don't have to work to be friends. Just your familiarity and your connection, you're just almost by default friends. Or you've got friends that you choose not to hang out with, not because you don't like them, but just because you don't need to. You're going to see them tomorrow anyway. It's very different in the workplace, where I think there's a big difference between seeing them at work and hanging out with them outside of work. I mean, it can be the same thing at school, but especially in the workplace, and I have a feeling in college too, like, hey, do you want to hang out outside of work hours? So for me, it took years. Like, I had been working at Disneyland for maybe 3 years before I ever hung out with anybody outside. And I mean, like, I had roommates and stuff like that, but that's still a little bit different. So this guy, David, the comedian, he was kind of the instigator. Ironically, he wasn't part of our group. We never hung out with him again. But he somehow kind of got us connected. And the nice thing was is that a number of the group was already connected because, like, I hired him with this guy named Daryl. And then he was really close with Adam's. What is Jeff your second cousin, third cousin, once removed?
He's my brother-in-law's nephew.
Okay, so he's not.
However, but anyway, that works.
there's a family connection. So anyway, so Daryl and Jeff had been lifelong friends, and then we kind of one of the other guys that I hung out with, Nick, like, we loved Nick, and so then that kind of became our group. And then their friend's name was Ryan, but we always called him Newman for some reason. I don't know. I never figured out why. And he didn't even work for Disneyland. And so then that kind of became our little group. And so, yeah, we had plenty of nighttime shenanigans. I think I mentioned the only night that I showed up to work on zero sleep was because we were out doing nighttime shenanigans, and we found an M80 and we threw it in a trash can and just to hear it explode. But still, my favorite? Oh, goodness. It was the night that we all seem to remember, and it's the reason that we're no longer allowed to hang out or weren't invited to each other's weddings.
Ominous.
It was at 2 a.m., and I had this knack for if someone's going to be like, well, what are we going to do next? Like, I'll give you an idea. I'm an ideas guy. I generally don't expect people to listen to my ideas, but if I'm the only one given an idea, people seem to just go with it. So we had some ideas at 2 a.m., and the nice thing was is we weren't really drinkers, so it's not like we were drunk or anything like that. I mean, we were over 21. So regardless, the night came to a head as we got pulled over by the police. Not for any particular reason. I think just because it was late and we were a suspicious vehicle. And at the time, to give you this picture, so it's Nick's car. Nick is driving. Newman is in the back seat, and for some reason, to get into nighttime shenanigans, he decided to put on full camo and paint his face in camouflage colors. So he's sitting in the back seat. I'm sitting in the front seat wearing what I was wearing that day, which was blue jeans and a polo, a UCLA polo t-shirt. But I also have one of those giant foam cowboy hats on my head.
What?
In the front seat. So they pull us over, and I just kind of have this snapshot of my head of like, oh my gosh, like, what are we doing right now? So the police pulls us over, has us all get out of the car, sit on the curb, kind of do the whole, like, have you guys been drinking? No, sir, no, sir. And Nick is freaking out. Like, he's, no, 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 I've never had a drink of alcohol in my entire life. Like, no, no, no. And then, and Newman is kind of like, dude, it's going down. Like, he's getting into, like, his military mindset or whatever. So he sits us all down. He pulls us over one at a time to kind of interrogate us. And Nick is terrified, so he kind of makes up this story for some reason, but he makes it up really loudly. So he's like shouting his version of the story so we can all hear it. But of course, then the cop thinks that he really is drunk. That's why he's talking so loudly. So anyway, he finally, the cop is convinced that nothing has gone wrong, but he sits us all down and he's like this, you know, 60, 65 year old guy. So literally he starts pacing back and forth in front of us. Because boys, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm 2 weeks away from retirement, and I'm too old for this crap. And they're like, and we're, I mean, well, at least Nick and I are, mostly Nick is terrified. So, you know, they put us back in the car and send us on our way. And so, yeah, terrified, Nick's like, okay, who's the closest house? That's whose house we're going to, and we're sleeping there. Like, there's no question. So.
Now, the other group that we spent a lot of time with, we've talked about this location at length in this break room, was Goofy's Kitchen. And I feel like as a result of just that exposure, like Jeff said, you're kind of forced into building some sort of relationship as you're sitting in this semicircle, essentially, in that room. So we have some stories about that morning crew. I'll share one here, which is, I'm titling it Mr. Pope's Wild Ride, or Adam's U-Turn of Doom.
Excellent.
So Jeff had been working there for quite a while, got very friendly with the veteran of the department who had been Donald Duck since the 70s, Glenn. And Glenn was just a real kind of like wry sense of humor. He's always like, hey, yeah, he kind of mess around with you a little bit. But you can also tell he's kind of like tired. He's kind of like, guys, I'm kind of done with this, you young guys. But he and Jeff got to be friends, and one of Glenn's passions was cars. Now, he raced, didn't he? Didn't he go to, like,
still
racetrack?
Does. Yeah. He still does. You can go down to the Pomona racetrack in California, and he still races his Pinto.
Yeah. And so, and Glenn is a little person, you know, obviously fitting in the Donald Duck costume. And so we got invited one weekend to go over to his house because Jeff had a classic car, this Mercury Comet that he inherited from his grandmother. And so he was needing to fix that up, and Glenn knew how to fix things. And so he's like, oh yeah, I know a guy, we can get some parts, we'll do this and that, you know. So, but we got to go to Glenn's house, which was really cool. He had a pool table and he had all sorts of different, you know, fun stuff because he was one of those, you know, awesome people. And so anyway, well, we're gonna go to this parts store, but I said, oh yeah, I'll drive, guys, don't worry, I'm cool. Because you gotta remember also, at this point I didn't get my license till I was 18, so driving for me was a big deal. I'm like, let me drive you guys, I'm the cool guy. So anyway, we're driving, Jeff is in the back seat for some reason, and Glenn is up front with me. I think because he was gonna have to give us directions, so it made more sense for him to be up there with me. So we get our lunch, and then we're pulling out, and I was not the most cautious driver in my youth. I actually got pulled over once for cutting off a police car. So, you know, I just I wasn't too careful. And anyway, so we pull up to this intersection, and I see that the light is turning yellow, but I'm like, guys, I can make it. So I just pull up to the turn lane, and I just flip this wicked U-turn, like, just so harsh that it just throws around. And you just see Glenn, it's like he's doing some sort of training to be an astronaut. He's just like flat into the back of the seat looking at me, his eyes are wide, he's like, aah! And then we're driving, I'm like, hey, we made it, you know, we got all the other cars that were the oncoming traffic behind us, like right up on us, and yeah, all right, so where are we turning? Glenn just looks at me, he's just got this like, who are you and why am I in this car? And it was just the face I'll never forget. And I was just like, oh, this veteran is never gonna let me live this down. And he didn't. I mean, on future shifts, he'd be like, yeah, you want to get in the car with Adam, take your life in your hands, you know.
Honestly, Glenn, especially if you worked for Disney, if you worked in the character department and you're listening to this, you know who Glenn is. If you didn't, if you worked after Glenn, like, find out who this man is. Ask a veteran and they'll know, because Glenn is one of the most amazing humans I've ever met. Like, Glenn is, and I mean, even, like, Adam, like, you're talking about, and I do want to clarify when you're saying, like, he had this tired sort of thing, not performance-wise. Tired-wise, just as far as, like, oh, you crazy kids running around in the break room. And he'd been doing, I mean, because literally the man played Donald Duck for 30 years. Every single commercial that you saw from the past 30 years that had Donald Duck in it, that was him. Not only was he just a, like, the fact that he could do it after 30 years and still have so much joy in doing it was spectacular. I don't know about you guys. I had never known a little person before. And just knowing some of the things that he has to go through as a minority, because his wife is a little person activist and his son is an active performer. But just his view on life, again, especially because in the formative years of my life, were just so incredible. Just the way that he looked at life And even the fact, too, is that, like, he talked about at one point, is that the harsh reality is that the lifespan of a little person is usually fairly short. And so he was talking about, like, in his 40s, he's, like, realizing that, like, hey, like, honestly, guys, I don't know how much time I have left. And that he was that comfortable with who he was continues to really be awesome. And again, he loved his cars, and he loved Donald Duck. He, like, and I keep wanting to tell him because... I keep wanting to tell him that my son AJ's favorite character is Donald Duck, and it's it's really tough that he's never gonna meet the real Donald Duck because he retired. And I really hope he gets to meet Glenn though, because he's Donald Duck. Whew. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. He embodied it full force, absolutely. But you mentioned Joe, you know, and like you said, you got to know Joe a little bit better as the years went on and kind of invited into his inner circle where he wasn't going to send so many jabs your way. And in fact, he trusted you to participate in an annual tradition at his parents' house.
That might have been unrelated. A lot of the characters, actually, that's the interesting thing. A lot of characters actually would participate in Knott's Scary Farm. A lot of the people in the character department would go over and work for Knott's Berry Farm because they could actually get paid pretty well to do Knott's Scary Farm. And Joe loved that. So he had the aspiration because he lived with his parents until he was 40 or so, which some of it is the cultural. They were very Italian and some of that. That's what he would always say. We always gave him a hard time about still living at home. And especially because... with him, the thing that he would always brag about, or not brag about, at least tell everybody, is that his parents said, hey, if you're going to live here, you don't have to pay rent, but you have to have a job. So he literally found what he conceived to be the easiest job of all, which was a Disney character. And so that was why he worked there for so long, is because he could stay at home rent-free and have and not pay for food and have no concerns or worries or anything like that. So anyway, like you were saying, Adam, one year he decided to be ambitious and create a haunted house. Because you didn't get to go, did you?
No, I never got to go. I was so bummed.
Well, for someone with no expenses, he spent way too much money on what was not that impressive a haunted house. Because I was expecting a haunted house. But what he did is he built this wood facade in front of his garage, which enabled him to kind of turn his garage into a walkway with two rooms. And he had all of these big, like, oh, we're going to have, like, this guy with a chainsaw, and we're going to have this room, and we're going to do this, and I want you to be Hannibal Lecter. And I'm like, oh, okay, so is it going to be, like, a prison cell, and I'm going to try and, like, freak people out by, hello, Clarice, or whatever? No, we're going to strap you to a gurney, and we're going to put you in the mat. What? So what am I supposed to do? And so it was literally just me trying to escape, I guess, that was supposed to scare people. It worked, and I mean, really, if you've ever done a haunted house before, any haunted house is better than no haunted house. And that's kind of what we offered. So my big legend, which, and you can see Adam's version of the legend online, which I... There's also, I think, footage of me complaining about Adam's version.
I appropriated this character, yes.
You did, friend. Which, again, that's why I say it wasn't necessarily Joe's trust. It was more Joe's need. I need bodies. So he also brought one of our friends, Kevin, to participate as well, but didn't have a role for him. So he just gave him a mask, and he's like, here, I found a rake. Why don't you have this rake? This is scary. And so Kevin's like, what am I supposed to do with this? I don't know, like walk around and like shake your rake at people. Okay. And so Kevin was not that kind of like a creative, like he's not going to figure out stuff. So anyway, so he's got this mask and this rake and he just literally would just walk around and just hold a rake and just be like, hey guys, how you doing? I got a rake. Like that was about all. And he was bored out of his mind. So about halfway through the night, we were talking and he's just kind of like, I'm so bored. I'm like, hey, do you want to switch? Sure. So we switched because I had like a straight jacket and the Hannibal Lecter mask. So I took his mask and the rake. And then I figured out like, as I'm kind of playing with it, because I like improv and all. So then I figured out if I turn the mask around so that the hair part of it is in my face, and then I just start raking stuff, a rake dragging across concrete is kind of a creepy noise. So then I kind of turned into the haunted caretaker of this haunted house. So I would come along and be like, beware, the haunted house will come for your soul or something like that, which ironically people were more scared of me because I was talking to them than they were of the haunted house. So then the next year we decided to do it again, but the budget got slashed dramatically. So it kind of turned into more of the haunted front yard. And it was just me as Rake Man. And then Joe always dressed up as Beetlejuice. Every single year he had a very legit Beetlejuice costume, but he wasn't in character. He would just walk around and go like, boo, rah. That's not really Beetlejuice, but he would just walk down the street and just be like walking around talking to people and be like, hey guys, how you doing? Oh, kids, boo. Like, that was about all of his performance. So I had this whole character of Rake Man, and one of his cousins thought it was really cool, so he said, like, can I be son of Rake Man? I'm like, sure! So then we had this whole bit. But then the second year, Rake Man gave up on protecting people and was just the silent raker of leaves. And so people would go, and he would just shake his head and just be like, oh, you poor soul. People were freaked out that I wouldn't talk to them now.
So yeah, if you want to see how I really expanded the mythology based on Jeff's ideas, because he would tell me these stories, I'd get very excited. I'm like, oh, Rake Man, and I just never made it over there. So Rake Man, the Midnight Gardener, is on YouTube in a very poorly edited form, audio editing. So I apologize for all the pops and crackles. Very primitive software at the time when I was making it. Someday we'll get a remaster. But yeah, so that was very fun. But yeah, I would say the Goofy's Kitchen Morning Crew really had an eclectic mix of hobbies and interests. Mm. And so the other person in the crew who had her off hours, you know, some people do aerobics, she did belly dancing. And so, Jeff, what can you tell us about Dana Sue's belly dancing experience? Because you got to go see her perform.
Sure. Yeah. And Dana and I were really close. I remember when I hired in, and we kind of talked about this a couple of episodes ago, Goofy's Kitchen crew was set. Like, you couldn't break in because it was all veterans, and they were there every single day, Monday through Friday. And unless somebody called in sick, there was no getting in. And so it was the A crew. The first shift was Glenn, Dana, Adrian was the chipmunk, because then there was Shay, was always Baloo the bear. And then the B crew was always Suzanne, the one female Goofy. She was usually always there on that B crew. And so you had Michael and Suzanne were the B crew. And so the A crew, though, was the dream team, because they were the ones. I mean, again, Glenn had been there for 30 years. Dana had been there for 15 years. Peter, I forgot Peter. Peter was always there as the Goofy. Peter had been there again for 15 years. Shay had been there for 7 years. So he was the kid of the group. So then, yeah, getting to know Dana, who'd been there for about 15 years. Well, the two things is that, one, not only belly dancing, but she also had this thing about her sons. I don't know if you remember this, Adam, or you heard about this, is that she had this way of kind of like adopting some of these wayward kids that would get hired. And so I remember, like, it was a huge honor for her to take you seriously enough to quote unquote adopt you as one of her sons. She would literally refer to her sons. You're like, well, you got to take it easy on my sons. And like, hey, those are my sons, and like, and whatever. So like that moment I remember where she actually was like, you know, I think Jeff's one of my sons. I'm like, really? Me? Oh, my goodness. And so a whole group, and there was actually, we took a bunch of photos because a whole group of her sons went to go see her perform. She would perform her belly dancing at a hotel in San Pedro. And the interesting thing for those of you that are unfamiliar with belly dancing, and I think now belly dancing has actually become more of a like an aerobic. People will take belly dancing as a workout. The interesting thing is about belly dancing is that it is more of an art form. I mean, yes, don't get me wrong. I mean, like, you know, traditionally it is designed to be somewhat seductive, but far too many people, I think, get belly dancing and like striptease or something like that confused. And they are very different. And she would get very upset if you ever even dared to question that. Like, I remember one, and those, oh, rookies, is this one rookie totally came in and somebody happened to mention something about, we went to go see Dana belly dancing, and this rookie kid was like, you're a belly dancer? Are you the stripping kind? Oh, to this day, she probably still mentions that. Like, that was, and the whole room went silent. Like, did you just say that to Dana? Like, that's the end of you, kid.
Yeah, and I'll mention too, and Jeff, if you're still in touch with Dana, ask her if this is possible. But I was actually out of the country for a time. This was during my break period that Jeff went on this excursion. So he actually sent me pictures from that night, which I still have.
Oh, nice.
I'm actually looking at them right now. So I've, you know, Jeff posed with Data in front of a pillar, her full outfit, and then her in front of her sons that she is proudly displaying. So if she's okay with that, maybe down the line we can share that picture, because that's a pretty fun. Jeff looks so happy to be there, so proud of his adopted mother. But now the other part of this, the way that Jeff's relationship with Data evolved outside of being adopted there, I always found fascinating, which is there was a period of his life that I call Jeff Goes to War, because he got involved in a very niche group of people that there have been documentaries about this.
Yeah, so, well, and the interesting thing is it's not nearly as niche, I think, as it used to be. So the organization is called SCA, Society of Creative Acronyms. That was their title. And it's somewhere between a Civil War reenactment and a Renaissance fair. They had different events, but the main one would be twice a year, they would have a giant camping excursion, one to Arizona and one down to San Diego. Again, there was more smaller ones, but those were the two big ones in this area. And you would go and you would dress up in theme dress. So I still have my medieval style garb. And then the big event was the Saturday morning. You would line up and you would not so much recreate a historical battle, but it would be more...
You were a clan, basically, right? And the clans are going to war against another clan, and you're kind of having fake battles with foam weapons, right?
No, explain this. No, it was legit. But it's not like you're in character. It's not like nobody was showing up. I mean, if they were, it was kind of like, ah, ha, ha, you know, that's funny. And people would have, like, their medieval names or whatever. I don't remember what Dana's name was, but, like, Thorvald. I don't remember what Thorvald's real name was. I think it was Steve. But so you would have a name, but you didn't really have a character. It was hanging out and it was stuff like that. And for me, especially as a 22-year-old, and I'm camping with these, like, 40, 50, 60-year-olds, like, that was a pretty legit experience. But the actual battle part... So you would dress in armor, and the armor, it wasn't really theme. Its main point was not supposed to be historical recreation. Its main point was actually protection, because you would then have wooden swords. So it was almost like paintball or like archery tag or something like that, where there were rules that as you would be struck in the battle, or they would have like one-on-one duels or something like that, you had a shield and you had your sword. So if the opponent's sword hit you, like in paintball, you know, if you've ever done paintball, if you get hit with a glancing blow, that kind of doesn't count. But if you get hit solid, boom, you're dead. Same thing. You get hit by a sword and they just kind of like go ding and they barely nick the top of your head, you're fine. But if they go clang and they full on wrap you on the side of your helmet, like you're dead. They just chopped off your head, out you go. Same thing. You block your sword with your shield, you're okay. But they like ka-cha you in the arm, your arm got chopped off, buddy. Like, and that was the thing, too, is they didn't mess around. So that hurt. You wore the helmet, so you're not actually getting injured, but you would, I mean, I'm sure they got too many concussions and stuff like that. But, like, you got ka-thacked on the arm, you would have a bruise on that arm for a while. Like, it was not messing around, and people would get hurt.
So you gotta imagine, you know, if you're thinking in character, this is Goofy and Pluto going to war together.
Well,
you know?
Pluto, no, Dana would never fight. Like, that was not her husband at the time would, but very few of the women would fight. So then, like, Dana was more the experience, camping together, and she loved the group that she camped with. There was shopping, kind of like at the Ren Fair. That part was very similar, except for you never compare the two, because SCA was always like, no, we're legit. Ren Fair, they're a bunch of fakers.
Yeah, so I mean, just think of all these experiences that you get just by finding these people at Disney that are involved in this kind of stuff. Now, as we close out here, you know, the other part of this that we've mentioned in past episodes we'd eventually be getting to is the idea of Disney dating. Now, there's always that idea of dating at work is not a good idea, but at the same time, like Jeff mentioned up top, this was kind of like being in college. You know, it's kind of a more social atmosphere in a lot of cases, just based on the type of people, the outgoing nature of those who would do this work. And so, you know, you start to get to know people, you start to get interested. If you're a young guy or gal, you're looking for someone, you know, that you can spend a little time with when you take the costume off. So I will mention, you know, again, I was a young guy, and so I thought, well, you know, who am I going to date around here? And in particular, you know, I'll preface this by saying that this tale is going to be called Goofy Breaks Pinocchio's Heart,
oh.
aka Adam Dates a Woman. So there was a girl that I worked with in Toontown quite a bit, and I would just see her. She'd be playing, you know, she was Mickey Hyde, or I'd see her in Town Square, and she would play Pinocchio, which is a character I don't feel like we mention very often, but Pinocchio was in the park quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
When we were working there, and she was one of the regulars doing that. And she was also a veteran. Her name was Stacy, and she was part of that pretty veteran crew. And obviously, I had not been there that long, and obviously, she was much older than me. She's a 30-year-old woman. I'm a 19-year-old kid, but she was super nice and sweet. And so I said, oh, you know, I started sitting with her at lunch and kind of like flirting a little bit. She'd be like, you're a baby. But I just finally wore her down, and I convinced her, you know, to go on a couple dates with me, and we hung out. And so we just enjoyed each other's company, and I thought it was so cool, you know, that she had her own apartment. I mean, obviously, she's in her 30s. She's got it all figured out. That's great. Independent woman. So we dated for a little while, and then it got to a point where I was going to be leaving the company, and, you know, I was just like, I'm just going to be moving on to a different part of my life, and I, you know, I kind of had realized, oh, she's, you know, at a different stage of life than I am. And so this was actually interesting too, because she had some friends working at Disney. I'll mention also was my first experience of working with, you know, openly gay people. I had not ever had that experience. And so it was very interesting, you know, to hang out with her and her group of friends and see what their lifestyle was and just kind of get a broader view of the world and humanity, not my own little bubble. But what happened was I basically just kind of called her one day, and I was like, you know what, I think we're just gonna be done. I think this relationship's gonna be over for now, and we can both move on, do what we're gonna do. And I just remember, like, you know, she was pretty upset by it, and so immediately I felt bad about it, just the way that I was so blunt about it. You know, I could have got out, I could have told her face to face, all these things, these immature actions that I took. So, and I remember, like, you know, calling, and her friend was like, yeah, you need to not call back here, she's pretty upset right now. And I was like, oh, I'm a bad person, you know? And so I eventually got a hold of her. I apologized. We didn't go out to lunch. I just kind of explained where I was coming from. And I don't know how satisfied she was, but at least I made an effort to apologize. So now I'm gone from Disney a couple years, and I come back to work there. And obviously, she is still working there. She still is beloved and a very integral part of the department. So I come back in, and I just remember getting the stink eye from a lot of people, you know? So, and like I said, we were basically on good terms, but still, like, that lingered. I'm sure she explained to her friends, you know, how uncaring I had been in the breakup process. So that was something, like, where I learned, like, a big lesson there, which is, you know, A, like, yeah, dating somebody at work, not a great idea. And B, you know, can you just have a little class? Have a little class if you're gonna call it quits on a relationship and you're just not feeling it anymore. Let's just be realistic. And I will say 100%, she was a very good girlfriend, and she was very kind throughout all of it. There was no reason other than my own decision as a young guy saying, ah. So anyway, I will apologize publicly once again, Stacy, but she did end up marrying a guy who worked at the park. Life was good. So I feel like, you know, it worked out for the best in the end. But Jeff, I know you also were always kind of looking for a dating opportunity here and there. Do you have any fun stories?
Wait, what?
I just feel like Jeff's dating was more sporadic, where I would always jump into relationships.
Wait. Now, something that does need to be said then is that you realize, Adam, like, you were in dating mode, man. You were, like, boom, 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 boom. And also, like, yeah, you weren't messing around, so you were like, okay, like, where's this going? All right, you're out of here. Next. Okay, like, you were, because, I mean, again, you dated Nikki for a while. You were gung-ho. So I'm not as bold or as motivated, I suppose. So, you know, in the and not only that, but like, because I didn't date at all in high school. I'd like to say that was by choice, but it wasn't. But then, like, yeah, my first girlfriend was just before I had started working at Disneyland, and then had two more girlfriends before I met my wife. So, you know, yeah, working for Disneyland for 6 years, I went on I would say I only went on maybe 4 or 5 first dates. So in 6 years, I don't think that's a lot, personally. I mean...
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that you were always dating. I was saying, but it was always on your mind, and you were trying to find ways to set up dates.
Even that. So, because we talked about your connection with my dating, and it was not pleasant, my friend. Like, you still have that black mark on your record. So, again, transitioning from high school, it was the dances. The dances were my excuse, where it was just kind of like, hey, do you want to go to a dance with me? Like, oh, that's a much easier way than just being like, do you want to grab food or something? That was very awkward for me. So I was always a very events-based dater. Because my hope was that they wouldn't be sold on me, of course, so maybe they'd be sold on this event. So I think one of the first ones, and actually Adam and I went together, was I got tickets through Disney for Lion King on stage at the Pantages. So I had the guts to ask one of the gals, Loretta, to go. Unfortunately, having never really driven to downtown Los Angeles before, I totally misjudged traffic. So I picked up Adam first, and then she lived in Downey, which was on the way to LA. We got to her house, I think it was like 2 hours after we said we'd pick her up, and this is before cell phones, so I had no way of telling her that I was running late. And I didn't want to pull off the freeway and like go to a payphone or something like that, because then we'd be even later. So we showed up to her house, and I think she had like changed already, because she's like, I don't think they're actually showing up. But then, ironically, we went on two more dates after that. So it didn't obviously go anywhere. But then, yeah, like we had talked about when we had Nikki on, Adam's horrible, horrible role in that, which you took credit for, like, well, at least you guys like ended up dating and all. Like, yeah, so Nikki and I ended up dating for about 6 months, and then a couple of more dates. Again, one of them, I invited them to a Star Wars convention. So that was my hook. That one didn't go very far. And then another one I took, I think we mentioned Bethy in the first one. I took Bethy to a Harry Belafonte concert, which was spectacular. And it wasn't even supposed to be a date, but it went so well that I'm like, maybe we should look at this. And no, that was not good. Not that it wasn't good. It just, there wasn't anything there. Because ironically, even like when Judy and I started dating, that was the same thing, is that I wimped out, and instead of saying like, I would like to go on a date with you, or let's go grab, it was, hey, I know there's this, what was it? Oh, there's this Star Wars thing in town. Let's go as a research project, I think was my hook. So that time it worked, though.
So you learn things, you have experiences, you're young people. That's what this is all about. We hope you enjoyed this little deviation from the format. You know, we still give you plenty of Disney insight, what it's like behind the scenes, how we took it all in, but I think there were a lot of fun stories mixed in to this topic. So next time around, episode 8, we're going to stick with what the employee bonding experience was like, but from a very different perspective. And what we wanted to share with you, what are called employee cast nights, special events, an award ceremony called AFASAB, and all these things will start to make more sense as we get into that conversation. So we want to invite you to come back next month. We are, again, still working, trying to bring in some of the characters that we've mentioned in this episode, even, see if we can't get them in to tell their side of the story. But, you know, who knows? If we don't get to our bonus interviews now, maybe down the line after episode 12, that's the new format of the show. Maybe we'll move into the interview side and get more people's stories that'll bring out some memories that we had forgotten. So, again, thank you so much for joining us, for being a part of the Two Gooks experience. And until next time, well, yuck, bye.